Today is Tuesday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a Pennsylvania community comes together in the wake of a murderous rampage at a house of worship.
Our synagogues and other places of worship must never become places of fear.
The Trump administration is sending thousands of military members to the U.S. border with Mexico. And the mystery of why an Indonesian jet with 189 people on board plunged into the sea just after takeoff.
Officials are saying that they are not expecting to find any survivors.
It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump and the First Lady Melania Trump will travel to Pittsburgh Tuesday. That's 3 days after a mass killing at a synagogue in the city. Trump and members of his administration are blaming the news media for inciting anger in the country, leading to the shooting, as well as the mailing of explosives to political critics of the president.
Tomorrow, the president and First Lady will travel to Pennsylvania to express the support of the American people and grieve with the Pittsburgh community.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto telling reporters he had asked the White House to hold off on a presidential visit until after the victims' funerals Tuesday. At the request of the mourning families and ongoing resources of law enforcement dealing with the aftermath of the shootings, some Jewish leaders in Pittsburgh in an open letter asked that Trump not visit the city until he condemned white nationalism. Asked about that on Monday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders noted that while those in Pittsburgh are grieving and hurting, the president wants to be there to show support of this administration for the Jewish community, adding that the rabbi of the Tree of Life congregation said Trump would always be welcome there.
Some individuals, they're grieving, they're hurting. The president wants to be there to show the support of this administration for the Jewish community.
The victims of the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history were doctors and dentists, accountants and academics, retirees and senior citizens who didn't let age get in their way. Two were brothers, another two a married couple. One was 97 years old. All 11 shared a dedication to the Tree of Life Synagogue where they were killed Saturday in the shooting rampage. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers was presiding over worship services when the massacre took place.
I helped pull out the people that I could from the front, but alas, I had eight people in the back. One fortunately survived. Seven of my congregants were shot dead in my sanctuary.
And while many are hailing the rabbi a hero for saving many lives, Myers himself says he'll live for the rest of his life with the grief of not being able to save more.
For a moment, I felt like I'm standing at a cemetery and this is a massive mausoleum. And it's my home and it's been desecrated.
Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt spoke at an interfaith vigil in Washington, D.C. on Monday night.
We gather here tonight purposefully in this holy place, a sanctuary, as a small measure of tikkun, of repair, in the wake of destruction, to mourn, to grieve, to remember, and to show resolve and courage in the face of hatred.
Also at the service, the state of Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan said Saturday's attack at the synagogue was an assault on the American way of life.
Our synagogues and other places of worship must never become places of fear. An attack like this, which cuts at the very heart of our values as Americans and as human beings, is an attack on the Jewish people, but it's also an attack on all of us.
Senior Vice President with the Anti-Defamation League, George Sellum, said hate speech is actually on the rise in the United States, as are hate crimes.
There was a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in calendar year 2017. That's the largest single-year increase on record.
Meanwhile, the accused synagogue gunman made his initial court appearance in Pittsburgh on Monday. AP correspondent Warren Levinson has that.
Robert Bowers was released from a Pittsburgh hospital and turned over to federal authorities, who brought him to court in a wheelchair. The 46-year-old defendant spoke with attorneys and confirmed his identity to a judge. He made no public statement at his initial court appearance, other than to confirm who he was. Bowers, who was wounded in the gun battle that preceded his arrest, faces a 29-count federal criminal complaint plus state homicide charges. Authorities say after he was taken into custody, he told them all these Jews need to die. The first funerals are scheduled for Tuesday. I'm Warren Levinson.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump will visit grieving Pittsburgh congregation amid the anger and blame. U.S. authorities say a mail bomb suspect had a list of other potential targets. U.N. rights experts urge Saudi Arabia to stop six imminent executions. And 189 people are feared dead after that plane crash in Indonesia. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. Defense Department is sending more than 5,000 active duty troops to harden the southern border with Mexico. The AP's Ed Donahue reports on the migrant caravan making its way through Mexico.
The caravan has been slowly moving north. General Terence O'Shaughnessy says these new troops will have mission-enhancing capabilities.
We have the authority given to us by Secretary Mattis. The units that are normally assigned weapons, they are in fact deploying with weapons.
Andrew Meehan with Customs and Border Security says there is already a humanitarian crisis at the Mexico border.
CBP has encountered a combination of almost 1,900 persons apprehended crossing our border illegally or presenting without documents at ports of entry.
President Trump has said the migrants include gang members and some very bad people.
I think the president has made it clear that border security is national security. That is the direction we've given. That's the direction that we're marching to.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
Well, the troops will be in addition to nearly 2,100 National Guardsmen already along the border. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAllenin says there are currently 3,500 men, women, and children in Mexico slowly making their way to the U.S. President Trump tweeted that the military is waiting for the, quote, invasion, and said there are some very bad people and gang members in the caravan. Joining us now is Rachel Schmidtke, Program Associate for Migration with the Mexico Institute. What can you tell us about what is known about this caravan?
These migrants from the Northern Triangle, I think this caravan is especially made up of Hondurans and Guatemalans. You know, they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing endemic poverty. The reason why they travel in these caravans is because it's much safer to get through Mexico to the United States traveling in numbers. And there's no evidence that there's any sort of terrorists or anything like that in the caravan. There's quite a lot of women and children, very young single men. But for the most part, they're not posing any sort of like threat to the United States. I know President Trump was saying that he only will let people in through legal means or they'll be turned back. But I mean, the majority of these people in this caravan are likely going to apply for asylum, which is a legal form of entering the United States, and it's protected under international law. They have every right to apply for asylum.
It sounds like, from what we've heard, that the administration plans to just turn everyone away and say no entry. Certainly heard that the other day from Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen.
The number of people that are coming to the U.S. border is not, I would not classify this as a crisis in any way. We're seeing that the number of illegal crossings to the United States is at an all-time low. And as I mentioned before, the majority of people are applying for asylum. So I think that this sending, 5,000 troops down to the border, so much news coverage, tweeting about this constantly, threatening to cut off aid to Northern Triangle countries, threatening and putting quite a lot of pressure on Mexico to contain this migrant caravan. I think it is a disproportionate reaction to the actual number of people that are coming. And I do think that in some ways, this is a way to sort of placate Trump's base. You know, he started off his campaign saying that he wanted to build this wall. He's wanted to come down on immigration. And I think knowing that there is a midterm election coming, I think the president wants to show that he is doing something in terms of migration and immigration. And so, and let's be fair that the caravan definitely, the previous one in April, definitely he was not a fan of. And he sent troops down to the border then as well. So I think that is not something new that we're seeing, but I do think that this caravan is much larger than the previous one, and the midterm elections coming up are adding fuel to this sort of fire.
Well, we've got the midterm elections just a week away, but my understanding is that the people in this caravan, we don't know how many will actually make it all the way to the U.S. border, but could be several months away because they're walking.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's going to take a long time for them to even get to the border. As you said, they're walking, they're traveling maybe by bus every once in a while, but they're quite far away still from the U.S.-Mexico border. They're still kind of still in southern Mexico. So we probably won't. And also, so Mexico is actually doing some interesting and I think pretty pragmatic policy responses to the caravan. They're, you know, soliciting UNHCR to help process asylum claims. They're offering some temporary work visas. They're offering even schooling for migrant children. They're kind of opening up all these legal avenues and help to migrants up at Mexico's southern border. And that's actually, they have about, I think, close to 1,000 people that have applied for asylum in Mexico. And then, you know, not only that, just walking through Mexico, the dangers that that entails. Some people will be dissuaded and turn around. I mean, the last caravan, it was only a portion of those people that actually made it to the U.S.-Mexico border. And from what I've seen, the majority of people that actually made it qualified for asylum. They did have very credible fears of violence in their home countries. So I think that we'll probably see less numbers than are actually in the caravan currently because of Mexico's response and just the travel. And I think when they get there, I think it will be difficult to justify turning away people who are seeking a legal and internationally recognized form of entering the U.S.
Is it legal for the United States to turn away people seeking asylum?
With asylum, you have to present yourself at a port of entry, which is what these people are doing. And yes, under international law, like, if someone is saying that I have a credible fear and I cannot return to my home country, then the U.S. does have an obligation under international protection law that they have to let the person in to at least apply for asylum. Now, they can be detained, which is what the U.S. is currently doing, is typically detaining people while they wait for their immigration case to be heard, which can take quite a long time. But no, I don't think they're allowed to turn people away.
With the president sending more than 5,000 members of the military, my understanding is it's just about 5,000-6,000 people that are coming. So that's like one military member per person.
Yeah.
Well, what can the military do? What should we expect them to do? And should we be at all concerned that there could be violence from either side, whether it's the migrants or the military?
Sure. I mean, we saw in Mexico southern border that the situation definitely escalated when Mexico sent police force down there. And I don't want to speculate of what will happen this time around, but I do think that it could likely be a tense situation. The military, they can't perform immigration duties, border patrol duties, so they can't be processing asylum claims. I don't even think that they're allowed to come into contact with migrants. So basically, they'll be deploying these troops, and I'm not really sure what they'll be able to do, you know, perhaps interrogating people or assisting with arrests, but and maybe manning checkpoints. But other mm-hmm. than that, they can't really do too much. And I think that number of military is most likely more of an intimidation tactic than I think it is a practical one. And it's quite a misuse of resources. I think it's pretty expensive to send a military down to the border. I don't think it's a proportionate solution to what's happening. And I hope that there's no sort of violence, but I do think that there will be a tense situation if there's a large number of migrants that make it to the southern border.
That's Rachel Schmidtke, Program Associate for Migration with the Mexico Institute. Rescuers in inflatable boats have retrieved human remains, pieces of aircraft, and personal belongings from the Java Sea after a new generation Boeing jet operated by an Indonesian budget airline crashed Monday, minutes after takeoff, killing all 189 people on board. Distraught family members struggled to comprehend the sudden loss of loved ones in the crash of the two-month-old Lion Air Boeing 737. They gathered at crisis centers set up by authorities at the airports, hoping desperately for a miracle. But a top search official citing the conditions of the remains recovered said no survivors are expected. As investigators prepare to understand what happened, VOA's Victor Beatty asks aviation expert John Cox, CEO of the Washington-based Safety Operations Systems Aviation Consultancy, about the aircraft itself and the often difficult terrain in Indonesia.
Well, the 737 is a workhorse of the airline fleet. It's been in production since the late 1960s, and there have been a whole number of improvements along those many years, the latest being the 737 MAX 8. So this is a proven airframe. It's a proven workhorse. And this is the most modern, up-to-date electronics, computers, and engines, the most fuel-efficient model of the 737. So it has quite a lengthy history that investigators will, of course, look at. The area around Indonesia in general can be very challenging in that there are mountains and it's some of the islands are pretty remote. It has beautiful resorts such as Bali, but also it has large mountains and it has not got the most extensive infrastructure system. So it can be a challenging area for pilots, but fortunately, the newer generation airplanes, such as the 737 MAX 8, have got onboard flight computers that make the job of navigating a good bit simpler.
Well, John, the weather apparently was not a factor. It was clear at takeoff. Data from Flight Radar 24 showed the first sign of something amiss about 2 minutes into the flight when the plane reached about 2,000 feet or 600 meters. It descended more than 150 meters, veered to the left before climbing again, where it stayed during most of the rest of the flight. Does that give you any clues?
The first thing is, as an accident investigator, you have to really validate the data. So the initial raw data says that the airplane descended. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We need to validate those data points. But there is indication that it climbed to 5,000 feet, and that would be normal if the crew were having some type of abnormality. That's a good altitude. You're well away from the ground, and it gives you an opportunity to go through the checklist, to do the problem solving necessary. They determined that they wanted to return back to Jakarta. They didn't declare an emergency, which all of this says that they were handling the situation, that they didn't feel that they were in imminent danger, and they did exactly what they're trained to do. They methodically went through the checklist. What went wrong after that, and the investigators will look very carefully at, but those answers we don't have yet.
The aircraft, after the ascent and the turnaround, began actually gaining speed in the final moments, reaching 345 knots before data was lost when it was at about 1,100 meters. Does that give you any further clues, or we're just going to have to wait for the black boxes to be recovered?
First, the recorders will tell us the entire story. But the limited data that we have, one of the things that struck me was, why is the speed so high? And if, in fact, that turns out to be true, then that will help the investigators understand that whatever was wrong in those last, say, 20 seconds of the flight, something appears to be terribly wrong here. And the investigators are going to look for what could possibly have caused such a rapid descent rate at such a high speed.
All right, that's John Cox, CEO of the Washington-based Safety Operations Systems Aviation Consultancy. The fiancé of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi says Saudi authorities know where his body is, and she called on them to reveal the whereabouts. Quote, I'm asking once again, where is his body? Hadis Kenzig Monday told a memorial service in London. She said she believes the Saudi regime knows the answer. The death of Khashoggi, an occasional Washington Post contributor and critic of the Saudi Crown Prince at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, has sparked global criticism of Saudi Arabia. Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate on October 2nd to obtain paperwork necessary for his upcoming marriage to Kenzig, a Turkish national. But when he didn't come out, she raised the alarm, and he was never seen again. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Monday that the Trump administration is considering possible actions in response to the killing. Saudi Arabia initially denied any involvement in Khashoggi's disappearance, but has since changed its account several times, and then last week admitted that the killing was premeditated. Joining us now is former U.S. ambassador and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. What is your reaction to the about-face explanation from the Saudis?
It's very confusing, obviously, to the outside. The indication to me, from what I've read and from what I've discussed with others, is that there's confusion on the inside there as well, that there was apparently no inkling that this would go wrong, which is stunning to me. Who knows how far up the chain it went in the planning of what appears to be a murder, but that it would not go wrong seems not that it would go wrong seems not to have occurred to anybody. So I'm just baffled by the tradecraft. I'm baffled by the logic, by the presumptions. And also, it does make a broader question when you go beyond just the question of the murder. What about the reliance of the United States on Saudi Arabia? That's been a linchpin of what the Trump administration is trying to do in putting a front, which is Israel, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, etc., against the Iranians. This will make that much more difficult because the basis of how the Saudis do business is under some question.
Most people I've talked to said it would be virtually impossible that the Saudi Crown Prince didn't know about this and authorize it. It's just not the way it works. I'm assuming you agree with that? And
I mean, I don't know the Saudi ins and outs of Saudi Arabia well enough to know that, but to do something this major, if this were a plot, and to do this without the knowledge of the people in charge would be stunning. It would be amazing.
Right.
So, yes, I personally find it very hard to believe that he didn't know. But I have no evidence. I haven't seen the other questions there. I think one thing that just seems very strange to me is that this was somehow considered, even if it was rogue or whatever, that this was considered an adequate or useful thing to do to deal with a guy like Khashoggi. It's amazing.
And it seems clearly that they just wanted to just get rid of their critics.
And also to scare others off.
And yeah, it would certainly leave the U.S. in a conundrum here, as you said, yeah, with the Trump administration's Middle East policies. But at the same time, can the U.S. afford to not react to this type of egregious human rights violation?
It's a real moment of truth, especially for people who are supporters of Trump, but who also believe in these kinds of questions. Think of some conservative Republicans who have, you know, both wanted to stand up for human rights and American values and also wanted to be hard-nosed in defense of American interests. This is a real hard time for them. And what happens here now is that you have the you have the possibility of a real, not a break, but a real tension within the United States on how to make a policy that's been based on Saudi Arabia, how to make it work. And indeed, even a deeper question is coming up among many conservatives, which is how much does the United States need Saudi Arabia? Which is a question that no one dared ask until recently. So this is really, there's a lot of levels on which this is really changing presuppositions, and there will be a debate for some time to come in Washington, I'm certain.
As a diplomat, what is, in your view, would be the best option for dealing with the situation?
No, I think the United States doesn't have to, there are times when you have to force an issue, and there are times when you see how things unfold. I think that in this case, the Trump administration wants to see how things unfold. And the United States has to make a decision. Does it choose to stand up for what is apparently a fairly egregious human rights violation? Or does it wait to see so all the facts are in, et cetera? And a lot of that decision will have a lot to do with what other people think of the United States as a reliable ally and someone who has a coherent policy. I don't think the United States, as far as I can tell, has decided that yet.
All right, that's former U.S. Ambassador and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. You're listening to International Edition on VOA. She said she too
young, don't want no man. Starting Monday, November 5th, tune into Border Crossings to win a free copy of Now 68, featuring top songs from a variety of artists. This CD features Calvin Harris's One Kiss, along with Ariana Grande's God is a Woman, and many other hit songs. Tune in to Border Crossings to win.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information. VOA's International Edition continues. Halloween, every October 31st, is a popular holiday in the United States. And HauntWorld.com estimates there are more than 4,000 Halloween fee-based attractions in the U.S., with the overall industry generating more than $1 billion. VOA's Jill Craig takes us on a behind-the-scenes tour of a popular haunted forest in Maryland, where people pay for a night of fright.
Disorienting. Creepy.
Would you like to be my friend?
Disturbing.
Kissy!
But all part of the experience.
Hello, lovely. Welcome to Markov's Haunted Forest, where your deepest nightmares become true.
Creating these nightmares and making sure they are done safely is all part of Paul Brubacher's work at Markov's Haunted Forest in Dickerson, Maryland.
As an American population, we are very fortunate to live in relative safety 99% of the time. And I think we get complacent and we need to have that jostled in our bodies, so we're willing to pay money to go out and have somebody chase us around with a chainsaw.
The official season begins in October, but training begins earlier, when more than 200 actors and staff members reunite for the start of a new season.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for committing to the Haunted Forest and joining our family. We love it.
Then the acting coaches get to work, teaching actors the art of the scare.
Hey, keep them moving. I'm teaching you ways to keep them moving. Don't do it by yelling words like get out or boo.
Before nightfall, actors select the proper costumes and props. Then they head for the makeup artist's chair.
We have quite a tight system where we have 120 people filtering upstairs. And we basically have, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes per person, each artist. And hence why we use airbrushes, because any other method of trying to do this was just too slow.
And once the action starts, it doesn't stop until the last customer leaves.
We're on our feet for 8 hours and we stay in character the entire time. We really strain our voice, we're talking, we're constantly using improv because we don't have scripts.
But actors say getting the scare makes everything worth it.
Did you see me?
When you're like a 5'5 small, you know, little girl, it's really fun to scare people who are huge, towering men.
As for the customers, they seem to enjoy it because they keep coming back year after year. Jill Craig, VOA News, Dickerson, Maryland.
Well, in Arabic, Anisa means an unmarried woman, and in Kenya, Anisa has become the first taxi-hailing service run by women. The new service targets women who don't feel comfortable or safe being alone with male drivers. It also gives more women an opportunity to become cab drivers. Faiza El-Masri has the story, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
In Nairobi, Kenya, as in many other big cities in Africa and around the world, heavy traffic is a common problem. With more than 3 million residents who need to move around the city, a number of ride-hailing apps have become popular. Anisa Taxi is one of them. Its cabs, driven by women, provide rides only to female clients. Duram Bora likes the service and says it provides security, comfort, and privacy.
For the security part, you see, when a male driver is driving you, you will have fear that anything might happen along the way, or even the driver will harass you. But when the female driver is driving you, you feel more secure, so you feel comfortable. Sometimes you can even remove the scarf in the car, you know, so you'll be comfortable.
According to Anisa Taxi founder Minaz Sarwar, the service is also empowering female drivers.
So we wanted to give an app which gives them more of a voice, more of an empowerment, working with them and making sure that they get good returns. These are single mothers, mothers who are working hard. So we really, really wanted it to be all about women empowerment.
Anisa Taxi charges lower fees compared with other ride apps that take between a 15 and 25% commission from drivers.
We are having a better offer, a better deal, where the commission is only 10% what they're taking from what we earn.
So far, the app has registered 60 drivers. Most of them are still in the vetting process. Minaz Sawar hopes more women will sign up in the coming weeks as the demand for the service increases. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.